Hi, this is Ken McCarthy from Jazz on the Tube, and this is our Ornette Coleman History Project. And what are we doing? Well, Ornette was one of the great musicians of the ages, amazing virtuoso on numerous instruments. And unless you had a chance to hang out with him a little bit, you don't even know half of it. amazing composer. I think one of the best composers of all, phenomenal band leader, and a peerless educator. And what we're doing with these calls is talking with people that actually worked with Ornette and getting insight into what that was like. Because Ornette Coleman, in addition to being an extraordinary musician, was also an extraordinary human being. And an educator, and that even that doesn't really describe it. So we're talking with lots and lots of guys and gals, so they can each give their piece of the puzzle. Because I'll tell you, in every one of these calls, I discover brand new things that I didn't know. So today we have the great good fortune to be talking with Chris Walker from Houston. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. How you doing?
Good, good. I'm always so happy when somebody takes the time out for one of these calls. I really appreciate it. And we're doing this for the future generations.
Right.
You know, when people listen to Ornette's music and they go, I wonder what that guy was like. We're going to have an answer. We're going to have not a complete answer, but a pretty good answer. We don't know exactly what Mozart was like. We don't know exactly what Bach was like, and we're never going to know.
Right.
But we're going to know a little. We're going to know a little bit of what kind of a person Ornette Coleman was. So, Chris, I always like to start with asking people how they found their way into music and realized that they were a musician, and what things helped you along the way to becoming a musician.
Well, for me, it started in our family gospel group called the Walker Brothers. My father had a dream and a desire to have his own group. So he had three boys, so he decided, I'm going to start a gospel group. And we were doing basically quartet gospel music all throughout, since I was a kid, throughout high school. And I didn't really know much about jazz until I attended the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts, and that's when my world opened up. Of course, it didn't prepare me for Ornette, but but my world opened up.
Okay. Great. So you know, we should all remember how important education, public education, is for the continuation of our culture. Ornette went to public school and got phenomenal training along with Prince Lasha and I think Dewey Redman, a whole bunch of guys all went to the same school. And then, of course, the great Captain Diet at DuSable, who trained so many musicians. And, you know, if we want future generations of musicians, we got to make sure the kids have a chance to get instruments and learn how to play them and learn theory, play with others. So this is a great reinforcement. So you got introduced to that world. And did you start right away on the bass?
Actually, I started off as a vocalist, singing in on the drums first. And the bass player that was in the family gospel group stopped showing up. So my father put the bass in my hand, and I play upside down like Jimi Hendrix. But I don't change the strings. So he said, you're playing bass now. He put my finger on a G and said, follow me. And that's how I started playing the bass.
We interviewed another guy, I think his name is Bill Crow, not in the Ornette series, but I think he started out on trombone, and it was a very similar thing. It was like, hey, we need a bass player. Here it is. Go to it.
I'm glad he did it.
Right. Yeah. So that's how you started. So what did you think at first when that happened? And when did you fall in love with the bass?
Well, actually, I was drawn immediately to the bass because there were so many guys on the local quartet gospel scene that I admired. And my love for the bass just grew. And I tell you, I used to practice like 6 hours a day because I attended a school called Jack Yates High School. In my ninth grade year, and I auditioned for HSPVA in my 10th grade year. But unfortunately, I couldn't read music, so I didn't think I would be able to pass the audition, but I tried anyway.
Okay.
To my surprise, teacher, you know, he accepted me. He heard something and told me I would have to work my butt off to stay in the school, and trust me, I did.
Great. And so you got that training, and then you know, obviously you graduated, and then what next?
Well, what next? After I graduated, I wanted to attend the New School for Jazz and Contemporary Music in New York City. But, of course,
okay.
I didn't have the funds to attend, and
right.
my parents couldn't afford it. I knew a gentleman by the name of Justin Page, who was a pretty well-established drummer on the scene back in those days. And he told me I could come and stay with him, I mean, until I found a place to live. So
wow.
I walked in the kitchen with my bags packed, and my parents thought I was absolutely crazy. And I said, I'm moving to New York City.
Oh, my God.
and literally, that's just how it happened. School was already a month in progress.
Okay.
And actually, the school told me not to come.
Oh.
But I went anyway, had a bass amp, sold it, bought a one-way ticket to New York, landed with $40. The
wow.
next day, I took a train down to the school because, of course, I've been hearing about it. I wanted to check it out for myself, and walked in, and I heard music coming out of the auditorium. So I poked my head in, and just so happened there was these guys on stage playing, and they didn't have a bass player. They saw I was carrying a bass, and they said, hey, would you like to play? I said, sure. So I jump up on the stage, and there's an amp there, and we started playing, and the dean of the school walked in and instructed over the program and gave me a full scholarship to go to school.
Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
Yes,
that's like
indeed.
A storybook. That's like a storybook plot. Wow. Okay. Well, you know, I heard a great saying from the comedian Steve Martin,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Just be so good they can't ignore you." That's the strategy to use.
Well, I don't know if that's true in my case. I'm a very humble spirit, but you know.
Okay, well, I'll say it though to provide context for
well,
young guys
you.
Out there. For young guys out there, you know, listening, and young women, you know, be so good they can't ignore you. Now, Chris won't take that, but I'm going to give you that advice behind his back. And
all right.
look where it led you. Wow, what a great thing. So you got a scholarship to the New School. Incredible.
Now, I'll tell you an interesting story. When I was in the 11th grade in high school, it was a class assignment, a project that we had to go to Miller Outdoor Theater and,
okay.
you know, I guess do a report on the performance. Performing on stage was Ornette Coleman that particular day and Michelle Petrucciani, right?
Wow.
So here I am sitting in the audience. Michelle Petrucciani went on first, and he performed, and I was like, wow, okay, I understood everything. Ornette came out, and I didn't know it then, but I know it now, and he started off with Song X.
Oh, okay.
I was like, wow, okay. I kind of understood, you know, the two bass players, two drummer concept, but they were killing. But after
right.
that, he totally lost me, and I think everybody else out in the park.
Right, right.
So I go to school the next day, and I ask my teacher. I said, well, what was he doing? And my teacher said, I can't tell you. I have no idea. So I made a decision then. I said, I could never play with somebody like Ornette Coleman because I don't know enough about music. And when I moved to New York, the first two people I record with, Michelle Petrucciani and Ornette Coleman.
No way. Unbelievable.
I tell you, God has a way of just turning things around and making dreams come true. But
wow. I, if you don't mind, I guess I have, because I had a kind of a similar but different story. I was doing a school paper, and mm-hmm. so I went to the Rutgers Jazz Study Center, which is, if no one's ever been there, it's in Newark. It's amazing. They've got everything. And I was studying the year 1959 in jazz, and I didn't even know Ornette Coleman's name. And, you know, I'm listening to Miles, I'm listening to all this stuff, and then the guy said, well, you got to listen to Ornette Coleman. So I put it on, and it just, same thing with you, it knocked me out. I could hear the musicianship. It was so amazing.
Right.
And then the same semester, I was writing a paper on paintings of Africa, modern African painters, and I studied mm-hmm. Twin 7-7. And when I finally met Ornette, I walked into his loft, and there on the walls were these big paintings from Twin 7-7. I was like, this is crazy. This is unbelievable. So I think a lot of this stuff happened with him. You're another example of just these amazing connections. So all right, so, wow, so you heard these guys, and then you found yourself in New York, and...
Right. Found
yeah.
myself in New York, and then one day I was in my apartment in New York, and I received a phone call out of the blue. And it was from Ornette.
Wow.
And he says, you know, I'm going to mimic his voice. He says, "Hi, I'm looking for Chris Walker. This is Ornette Coleman." And I said, "Wait a minute. Who's joking around with me?" So I said, "Yeah, right. This is really Ornette Coleman. Sure. Come on, let's go." And he said, "No, this is really Ornette." So once I realized it was really him, I said, "Well, yes, sir. Why are you calling me?" And he said, I was calling to see if he would be interested in playing in my band Primetime. Jamaluddin Takuma is no longer with me, and I heard that you're pretty good on the bass." So I said, "What?" I said, "Oh, my goodness." So long story short, he eventually came to my apartment and picked me up and took me down. He used to own a school building down in the village. So we go to this rehearsal space, and as soon as we walk in, it's pitch black. And Ornette leaves me standing there, and he says, "I'll be right back." And I'm like, "Oh, Lord, is somebody about to come out and jump me with?" But, of course,
lights came on.
We go into the rehearsal space, and it's just the two of us.
Okay.
And he gives me some music, and I believe it was Song X. And he played the melody for me. And then he said, "Okay, let's do it together." And he did it so fast. I said, well, I said, "Hang on, Mr. Coleman." I said, I can't play it that fast." And he was very gracious, and he said, "Oh, okay, let me." Then he slowed it down for me, and that began my relationship with Ornette.
Wow, unbelievable. And when you say school, that was the one on Rivington, right, in the Lower East Side?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. Now, maybe, and this is an important point I'd like, maybe you could comment on. Most people that heard Ornette play heard him on a record, or they heard him in concert, and so there was some electronics involved. I just want to know if your experience was similar to mine. When I actually heard him in this is when he was on Bowery, and he was teaching DiNardo a tune. He was showing DiNardo a tune. Mm-hmm. The purity of his tone, unamplified, I mean, it gives me goosebumps 30 years later just to think about it.
And let me tell you something. And I actually lived with Ornette for almost a year.
Okay.
And let me tell you something.
Wow.
I woke up because when I was in college, I didn't have, I mean, I didn't have any funds. And one day Ornette came to my apartment, and he noticed to give me some music or do something. And he noticed it was five guys sharing one room. Mm. We shared the bathroom with four of the people on the floor. So, of course, when the pipes would freeze, we had to heat up water on the stove and put it in the tub. But anyway, so Ornette, he noticed the pallet where I was sleeping on the floor, and he said to me, he said, "Well, you don't have to live like this. Why don't you come stay with me? I have an extra room that I'm not using." Mm-hmm. And at first I said, no, thank you, Ornette. And then he came back, I guess maybe a few weeks later, and he said, "Pack your bags, you're moving with me in the store." So I said, "Yes, sir. Okay. And let me tell you something. That time period in my life defined who I am today, because not only did I wake up to the sound of Ornette's horn every day, and he would never come in there and disturb me, but as soon as he heard me moving around and that I was up, he would come in and say, "Okay, let's get to work. Let's get started." And it would be sax and bass, or whether it was trumpet or violin. Every single day, we worked on music, every day. And we'd take a break, go to lunch, come back, and play until it was time to go to dinner, time to eat dinner. And that was our routine every day. But, of course, within that time period, we would talk about so many things related to music, life, his journey, his family, just everything. And I'm telling you, he shaped who I am as a human being. Because of his love and his passion and for people, for music, and just who he is, you know. So I'm grateful for that time that I was able to spend with him, you know.
Yeah, I talk to a lot of people that say similar things, and I can say it myself. I learned, and I hope I'm gotten better at it 30 years plus years later. Mm-hmm. I learned how important it is to listen.
Yes.
And what an art it is to listen to another human being when they're talking. Because not only was his tone out of his horn amazing, but when you'd see Ornette in conversation with another person,
right?
I never seen anybody before or since listen as fully as he did when he was with somebody. Does that ring a bell?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Not only that, but he was always an encourager as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, when I lived with him, I mean, I write songs, and I had a notating tablet, and I thought, like whenever he would come walking through the door, I would turn the tablet over and pull out my harmonic music because I thought he would be upset if he saw me working on anything else. But to my surprise, it was quite the contrary. He said, one time he walked in and he said, "What you working on?" And I showed him, and he said, let me check that out. So he grabbed his horn and started playing what I had written on the page.
Wow.
And he said, "That sounds pretty good." He said, Stick with
wow.
it. And years later, I released an R&B project, and I had most of the songs already written. Some of them I had written when I was staying with Ornette. And one of them, entitled Take Time, went top 20 on the pop charts. So,
wow.
I mean, thanks to Arnett encouraging me, he said, stick with it, So, that was just the type of person he was,
Yeah, absolutely. That was my experience, too. And it was just, I think I was whistling one day.
Oh,
and he said, you're a pretty good musician. Just wrapped up.
And you know what's amazing, too? Arnett didn't care where you came from, where he saw you, or whatever the case may be. If he thought you had talent, he would invite you. I mean,
yeah.
One time we caught the subway, and there was a guitar player in the subway. And Arnett, he caught our attention. So we stopped and we listened to him for a while, and Arnett walked up to him and said, you sound pretty good. I'd like to meet with you. The guy, of course, didn't know who Arnett was, but he invited him to a rehearsal. And when the guy heard the music, he was so startled and didn't know how to respond. The guy ran out and never came back. And I was like, man, he has no clue the opportunity that he's passing up right now.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Well, you had to be strong, and you had to be there.
Yes.
you had to be willing, like you did, to not understand,
right.
But be willing to understand in time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow. So, right. So now you're living in Ornette's place, and you guys are working together every day. And so did you go right into prime time? Was it that fast?
Yes. Yes. I did. I went right into prime time, and we toured. And I was the new kid on the block and the lost kid on the block, trying to understand harmonics, and I was bugging Arnett on a regular basis. I mean, every plane ride I wanted to sit next to him. Every bus ride I was bugging him. Every train. So I just knew he was, at some point he was going to say, "Man, leave me alone." But he never did. He always said, "Oh, come on, I'll answer any question you have." He told me that from day one, and believe me, I was always the one saying, "Now, in traditional jazz, it works like this. Explain how this applies via harmonics." And he would always graciously take his time and explain it to me.
Wow. So. I mean, he would explain harmonics to anybody that was interested, and always patiently. He tried to explain it to me once. I have a piece of music paper that he wrote it on while he was trying to explain it, and I was amazed. I'm thinking, my God, this guy's been doing this for decades and decades with hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and he just keeps coming and keeps helping and keeps explaining it. I should probably nail down some years. So could you just tell me the year you got to New York and then the year you started with Primetime?
I got to New York in 86.
Okay.
86, and I started in Primetime in 87.
Wow, Chris, you didn't waste any time.
And it's funny, I'll tell you another funny story. So, of course, while I was working with Arnett, I also received a call to work with a vocalist by the name. I went to an audition, and they hired me on the spot, Regina Bell. So I'm working with Arnett, and there was no conflict because they were touring at different times.
Mm-hmm.
So when we were working on the record that I played on, the Virgin Beauty record with Arnett.
Yep.
So we're in the studio. Regina Bell is opening at Radio City Music Hall for Smokey Robinson.
Okay. Oh.
So I asked Arnett, I said, "Well, Arnett, is it possible that I can take a break from the studio and go and play the concert and come back? Because we were starting like 10 in the morning and going till 2 a.m. every day. So he said, to my surprise, he said, okay. So after starting in the studio with Arnett at 10 and then trying to play an R&B concert with Regina Bell after playing harmonics all day was so challenging. And my brain, I mean, trying to adjust to that was the most difficult thing I ever had to do, because when you're playing with Arnett and you're thinking harmonically, it's tough to switch your brain to something else.
Oh, sure. Sure. So, it's almost like speaking English all morning and Chinese all afternoon, except I think it's even harder. I think it's even harder.
Right.
Wow. Wow.
But somehow I managed to get through it.
Wow. Well, hey, you know, maybe this is a time to start talking about what does it mean to think harmonically?
Well,
I know it's a tough one.
The bass, for example, before I was introduced to Arnett's music, I always looked at the bass just as playing the bottom and a support role. Well, Arnett changed that completely because he said, my bass, I mean, it could be a horn. Now, I mean, to think in terms of my bass as a horn or the approach of a horn, not just the bottom, but finding my own unison in my own voice, you know. So that's what he would do with each one of us. He would sit us down, and when we would rehearse, he would find each one of us, he would say, we have to find your own unison. Now, sometimes he would say, play it in the bass clef or the treble clef or the alto clef or the viola clef. And now, of course, he could do it fluently. I mean, you know, for me, of course, I mean, it was challenging because I wasn't used to transposing things like that. But he would work with me and work with each one of us until we found our own unison. And that's pretty much how he would do it every time.
Okay, great. And this raises a really important and interesting issue. I know he used the word unison a lot. What do you think he meant by unison? Because, you know, there's a technical meaning of unison, but I think he had a different meaning for unison.
I think when we're all playing together, your individual tonality, your individual sound is your unison. Now,
okay,
he may play something, he may play something that will make you go in a totally different direction. Now, the thing about it is, when we're all playing together, it's amazing how sound can take you in a totally different direction. I mean, when you think about all the various sounds that are coming together, but yet you can still hear Arnett in every note that he's playing, and it's almost like an octopus with tentacles, and he's touching each one of us on the bandstand, and feeding into us, and we can hear the direction that he's going. Not that we always understand where he's going, but because of the teachings, we had a better concept of where he was going.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Okay. Now, so, you know, in a traditional jazz setting, as you mentioned earlier, there's the leader, right, the guy out front, and everybody else is doing a supporting role, you know, drummer's keeping the rhythm, the bass player's marking the harmonics, and so on. But this was a different approach to ensemble playing.
Absolutely. Arnett would say, you're all the leader.
Okay.
Not just him. His approach was, we were all the leader. I mean, DiNardo could play something on the drums that inspire Al McDowell to do something totally different on the bass, or it may inspire Arnett to do something totally different. So it wasn't we were all following Arnett. It was we were all leaders in our own right, and the freedom to express that leadership at any moment on the bandstand with him.
Now, was it possible for everyone to be leading all simultaneously, or
Absolutely.
Did the leadership pass? It was possible. Okay.
Absolutely.
Wow. Wow.
Absolutely. And you had to listen because Arnett never counted a song off, and he never told you when the melody was coming. So if you're not listening,
really?
No, he never counted a song off. Never.
Wow.
If you notice, think about it. Have you ever heard him count a song off or seen anybody in his band count off a song. Never.
You know, you're right. No, I never heard that. Okay, ready? One, two. No. Wow. So in addition to all the musical issues, you had to be 100% there.
Absolutely.
Like, you couldn't be daydreaming or waiting for your cue or reading the paper, waiting for your part.
No. And see, the guys had, you know, I mean, when I got in the band, the guys had been playing with Arnett for a while.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, Al McDowell, playing opposite of Al McDowell, who is absolutely a beast, I was terrified because Al, I mean, he knew the music inside and out. So I'm over, you know, and at first I was over there struggling like a, you know, and Al would have his bass sitting on his lap and calling out the notes that I'm supposed to play. The next G, D flat, but he wouldn't pick up his bass and show me. I had to earn it.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I mean, as time went on, he saw that I was dedicated to it, and I would go home and practice like a madman and come back and be ready the next day. So after that, he kind of welcomed me into the family, and we became so close and good friends. I mean, but I tell you, he's just unbelievable, man. I mean, I still scratch my head when I hear Al play.
and that raises an important point. Ornette found a lot of great bass players over his lifetime.
Yes.
And I mean, starting with Charlie and, you know, Al and Jamal and and I mean, just, it's incredible. So he really loved the bass.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because he did something to give, well, I guess, just as you described earlier, he didn't look at the bass player as, you know, the guy in the back of the room, you know, plunking away. He looked at him as an absolute equal in a venture that everybody was part of on equal footing.
Right.
So that allowed the great bass players to shine.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And once I got over my my scariness of playing opposite of Al McDowell, but it was just, tell you, man, a wonderful experience, and I've never experienced anything else like it since.
Well, you really got thrown in the deep end of the pool right away. It wasn't like, I was talking with Dave Bryan, and Dave had the luxury of what he called auditing Ornette's rehearsals for years. Mm-hmm. Before the opportunity came up to join the band. It sounds like you just got the call, grab your bass, come on over. Let's go.
Well, when we met one-on-one, I guess he could sense the hunger and the eagerness to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't turned off. I was intrigued.
Mm-hmm.
And of course his demeanor, his spirit and all of that stuff came through in the music as well. So I mean, I wanted to know more. And I never stopped.
Yep. Just a side note, something you said earlier at the very when he first called you. I have to say that when I met Ornette, his voice was a surprise. I expected a fire-breathing dragon when because I thought this guy is such a genius. He's got so much energy. He's just doing all this amazing stuff. And this very very soft-spoken, very polite, impeccable manners.
Right.
I didn't expect it. I was kind of surprised.
Well, I didn't know what to expect because he didn't talk during the concert in Houston. So I didn't get have an opportunity to hear his voice until that phone call.
Right. I want to talk about if we could this issue of clefs. Now I'm a barely literate musician. And I do know that there's a treble clef and a bass clef. That's as far as it goes for me. But I know that different instruments have different – they read music differently. Okay. I mean, I know this is very basic stuff, but we probably have some listeners who are in the same boat I'm in. And I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit about this unique thing Ornette did with clefs and with asking musicians to get outside of the clef that they were comfortable in.
Well, for example, if sometimes he would ask me, like on the bass, sometimes I would play it in the bass clef, or he would write it actually he would say, or play it in the treble clef, as if the notes that I'm playing were in the treble clef, or if the notes that I'm playing were the alto clef. I mean, so basically the transposition that he would do for the alto saxophone, same thing for the viola clef, same thing. So basically I would take the notes that I have, and he would play through them. And as I stated earlier, he would do it so quickly. But of course, you know, to switch your brain around and you're looking at a note that's a C for a bass, which is an A for treble, which is a different note for the alto, and then it's a different note for the viola clef. So basically, he would take all those different clefs and play the parts in those different clefs to help you find your unison.
So he would go to your clef and play there to make it easier for you to understand what he wanted. Is that what you mean?
No, it was all about the sound.
The
different sounds that would come as he would transpose go through the various clefs. Now each time he did it, it would be a totally different sound from just your clef. Or like just the bass clef. Once you go through those different other clefs, a lot of times the sound would change completely, and sometimes that would appeal to him. Now, and he went through this process with each one of us.
Wow!
So your part is totally different from everybody else's parts. I mean, going through that process, there's no way your part is going to be the same as the next guy.
Okay.
So we would all just be patient while he went from each guy going through this process to help you find your unison. So when you put all those sounds together, there's so many different melodies going throughout it. It's just mind-boggling. It's just amazing.
Wow. Well, and again by unison, I mean because in a limited way, unison is two people playing the same note, right? Is that's the old-fashioned way of describing a unison.
Correct, but my interpretation of what Arnett was saying was unison, meaning your own voice and your own melody.
Okay, and then you also used the word tone earlier, and yeah, wow. Now I'm going to guess that Arnett was unique in using that methodology. That wasn't the way things were done in jazz or any other style of music.
That's
wow.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Now, what's amazing, too, most people probably don't know this, but Arnett, and you know, I was always messing with him and saying, okay, I wonder if he can really play, like, just straight-ahead jazz, because I'd never heard him do it. Well, to my surprise, we were in Europe one day in the dressing room, and Don Cherry was in the dressing room because he was playing with us. And I said, Arnett, why don't you ever play, you know, just straight ahead jazz tune. And he looked at me and he said, do you mean like this? He picks up his horn and he plays Donald Lee, lightning speed. I mean, plays the whole thing flawless and starts soloing and sound just like Bird.
Mm.
I'm like sitting there with my jaw on the floor.
Uh-huh.
What? And then he stopped and he says, I choose not to do that.
Oh my God!
I look here. I never bothered him again.
Unbelievable!
But he could
unbelievable.
Do that. He, I mean,
yeah,
he could play like that, no problem, effortless.
That's why. That's why. Whenever I describe him, I always say, in addition to all the other things that he was and did, virtuoso. You can't begin to describe the fluency he had on all his instruments. And I heard he did, yeah. By the way, I heard he did the same thing on trumpet.
It's true. It's so true because I experienced it. I mean, he even played some of my songs on trumpet. I mean, I had the music there and he said, let me see what it sounds like on the trumpet. So he picked up the trumpet and started playing what I had written on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, wow. Okay, Arnett. What do you want me to do next?
So for people, and there are people out there that don't necessarily understand, you know, what was this what was he up to? So I think the first important thing to understand was this was a choice that came out of very deep knowledge and understanding of music. He, you know, he could do all the bebop stuff inside and out and upside down.
Right.
And it wasn't what interested him at the end of the day. He was exploring this other realm of how to work with other musicians. Because that was, I mean, that's kind of a big part of it too. So virtuosos, amazing compositions.
Yeah.
But he was also, he was fomenting a revolution in how musicians related to each other. Is that accurate, you think?
Very much so. I think so. Yes, absolutely. And the thing about it is, to play Ornette's music, it's not a simple feat for, you know, I mean, I mean, it's not like you can just pick up one of his songs and just say, okay, I'm going to play it. No,
yeah.
It's not that simple. It's not that simple. And it's funny because recently, Donato and I, along with Jason Moran, did a concert in Houston for my nonprofit organization called DocFest that I started to give back to HSPVA students going to the new school in New York City. We raised scholarship funds for them. And, and you know, Donato and I hadn't played together in years.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Jason is a huge Ornette Coleman fan as well. So we got together and rehearsed in New York at Ornette's place. And, man, let me tell you, it was so magical. You don't realize how much you miss it until you're in it, and you're with like-minded musicians who get it and who are free enough to allow themselves to go to that place that you really don't have an opportunity to go to in most genres of music.
Mm-hmm. So, you know,
So it was magical, and the concert was just unbelievable. And in fact, we're doing another one in Houston for it's called the Camera series on the 21st of April. Actually, Donato and Jason and I, we're going to play probably about five or six Ornette Coleman songs.
Oh, great! And so that's April 21st. Is that in Houston?
Yes, that's in Houston.
Mm-hmm. And you said it's the Decamera series.
Yeah, Decamera series.
Mm-hmm. Decamera series. Okay, I'm going to look that up and make sure there's a link for everybody.
Okay, and it'll be at Discovery Green. It's called Discovery Green. It's an outdoor event.
Discovery Green.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anybody listening from Houston, just put it on your calendar. You don't want to miss it.
And it's free.
Wow. And it's It's not only free jazz, it's free jazz.
That's right.
I think Ornette did not like the name free jazz ultimately because everybody think they didn't have to pay for it.
Right. Because, no, it definitely wasn't free jazz to him.
Wow. I you know, what you're saying about the uniqueness of that method of playing, that manner of playing, I'd say it's more of a manner than a method, but that's a whole nother story. Like it's not something you can learn from a book. Though you did have to think a lot to figure out how to do it. It was something you had to. It's almost like manners. You know, you just had to adopt them by behavior, and you'd figure it out. But when I went to the memorial for Ornette, the very last thing that happened was Primetime played. Basically at the processional at the end as people were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And wow, the feeling I had when seeing everybody together and playing that manner of music, oh, it was just amazing.
I really regretted the fact that I couldn't be there. Although I made his 85th birthday celebration and got a chance to spend some time with him, but I was on tour in Europe with Al Jarreau, and I tried to work it out, but the schedule just didn't work out. So I sent my teacher, my high school teacher, Dr. Robert Morgan, instead. Just to pay my honor to Ornette and to Donato.
Will you be at? There's a show this summer in New York.
Absolutely, I will be there.
Okay, good.
And Primetime, yes.
And I think they're just selling tickets. They're doing pre-sale to members of Lincoln Center, and I just joined Lincoln Center so I could get those tickets. Yeah, no, you can't. One cannot miss that.
This is true.
And yeah. Now I'm looking for the date. I must have.
Let me see.
I thought it was in June.
Yes, it's in June, and I believe it's June. Let me see, 12th through the. Let me see, April. Actually, it's in July.
Oh, it's in July. That's why I couldn't find. Because there's a bunch of stuff going on. Primetime's playing. An orchestra is going to do an accompaniment to Naked Lunch, if I have that right.
Yes, and actually the dates are July 12th, 13th, 14th. I think Primetime performs on the 14th.
Yep, I got July it. Yep, it's in my book. So you know we're recording this in late March of 2017. So. If you're listening and you think you can make it to New York that date, I recommend everybody make sure you get a ticket for that because I think once they're available, they're going to go. And it is an amazing band. And this will be really like the alumni because the band had different members over time. So maybe you could tell us just for historical purposes, who was in the band when you were in the band?
Bern.
So Al Stahl, of course.
Yep. Bern Nix. Charlie Ellerby.
Okay.
Badal Roy came later, actually. Calvin Weston on drums. Donardo on drums. And that was it.
Okay. And which albums were you? What album were you on, or which ones?
Virgin Beauty.
Okay. And that was a...
Oh, go ahead.
Yep. That was a very important record because that was the first record Ornette recorded for many years. When that one came out, he hadn't recorded for quite a while.
Right. And one of the Tone Darling, I believe. Yeah, Tone Darling. Actually, I didn't play on Tone Darling. I was a guest vocalist.
Oh, you were a vocalist on Tone Darling. Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember the track? I'm making you go down memory lane on short notice. let me see if I'm looking up Tone Darling, Ornette. Let's see if they got the personnel.
Now, there's a possibility I could be confusing it with the performance that we did at Lincoln Center years ago when I sang with him. I was no longer in the band at that point, but he invited me back as a guest vocalist.
Okay. You're listed on personnel. And not only are you listed as a bass player, you're listed on keyboards.
On Tone Darling?
That's what the great and never wrong internet says. I'm looking on Wikipedia.
Okay,
and,
one of them. I know. I also sang on that one. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I believe so.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so and then tell me about your tenure. So you started in 87, and there was then Virgin Beauty, and it looks like you were on Tone Darling, and touring. How about touring? What kind of places did you go with the band?
Oh man, all over Europe. I mean, all over Europe. We did actually a tour once doing his Skies of America piece. Verona, Italy, Germany, Spain. I mean, France, I mean, just all over. And actually, I ended up staying with Ornette approximately 2.5, almost 3 years, because 1 year there was a conflict where Regina Bell was touring and Ornette were touring at the same time. And I wanted to pursue a career in addition to the bass as a vocalist. Mm-hmm. And I knew I couldn't do that in Ornette's band. So I had to make a choice, and I was Regina Bell's music director at the same time, and I was doing duets in the show with her. And, you know, I had to choose which way I was going to go, and I chose Regina Bell. And, of course, when I delivered that news to Ornette, he wasn't too happy about it. However, he called me up a few days later and said, you know what, go ahead and chase your dream. And he said, I'm here to support you. If you ever need anything, just call me and let me know. And we remained friends. We remained friends all these years, you know.
Yeah. He had a lot of long-time friends, I can tell you that.
Yes, indeed.
I mean,
and I'm
going to
tell you, in all the years I've known him, I've never seen him upset. Never. Never seen him angry. I've never heard him raise his voice or yell at anybody or anything like that. And then, you know, that speaks to his character as an individual, you know?
So, yeah, absolutely. Sometimes he'd throw you a look, though.
No, he could definitely give you a look. but still, you could feel the love even in the look.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I tell people he was like my second dad. I mean, he was that kind and that encouraging and that nurturing and that supportive. You know, and I bet he was that for a lot. I'm sure he was that for many, many, many people.
Yeah. And you know, to my surprise, I mean, not many people have an opportunity in life to work with an Ornette Coleman and an Al Jarreau. Now, I've been with Al Jarreau for 20 years. And, of course, I mean, as you very well know, he recently passed February 12th. But, I was playing in New York with Al. I forget the year. But I reached out to Ornette and invited him to the show.
Mm-hmm.
And to my surprise, he accepted, and he came with DiNardo. And I could only imagine what he was thinking during the concert. I was like, oh, my God. What? But to my surprise, afterwards, he pulled me aside. He said, this concert sounded great, Al. It's wonderful. And he leaned over and whispered in my ear, but don't forget about you. And your career, don't forget about you. And he smiled and kind of chuckled, and then he left.
Wow.
Still encouraging me years down the road, you know?
amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Hey, you know, since, you know, this is a call about Ornette, but you had this long-term experience with this great artist, Al Jarreau. You know, why shouldn't we take advantage of that while we're on the phone together? And maybe there's some things you could share with us about what it was like working with Al. Obviously, you liked it because for 20 years, it must have been an amazing experience.
Wow. I mean, I was a huge Al Jarreau fan throughout high school. And I received a phone call from Gil Goldstein, who had done some orchestra arrangements for him. And he called me up and he said, you know, we're looking for a bass player. And I thought about you for a singer by the name of Al Jarreau. Are you interested? I said, what? Are we talking about the Al Jarreau? So flew me out to California. I met him, and he hired me and asked me to join his regular touring band. And then shortly afterwards, I became his musical director. And let me tell you, man, just an unbelievable experience. I mean, Al and Ornette, there were so many similarities between the two of them.
It was interesting.
Mind-boggling.
They're both
Pisces, by the way. Al's birthday, March 12th. Ornette's birthday, March 9th. My birthday, March 17th.
You guys were swimming together.
Swimming together.
Wow, that's amazing. So both Pisces.
Yes.
And how else, what other similarities did you see between them?
Just their spirit and the way they communicated. And with Al Jarreau, you had to listen just like you had to listen with Ornette.
Mm.
Al challenged you in different ways. And he can't read music, but he can sing every note of the chord that he wants you to play. Mm-hmm. He can sing any part that he wants you to play for him.
Okay.
And for somebody who can't read music, I mean, he couldn't tell you the difference between major, minor, augment, and diminished, but he can sing every note in the chord.
Wow.
And tell you exactly what voicing he wanted.
Wow. So it was all in his head without any theoretical underpinning. He just knew it. He heard it. He could see it. He could visualize it. He could deliver it.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
He could. And his voice is an instrument with no boundaries.
Okay.
And he taught me, because, you know, my background vocally, I mean, of course, I learned all of his solos on his records. I learned the vocal parts and the bass parts. So when I received that call to work with him, I was ready. I was ready. I didn't tell him I was a singer. I was afraid to tell him when I first joined his band. So one day, we're in Europe, and he's running late for sound check for whatever reason. And so the guys asked me, well, you know, Chris, can you just test his microphone? So I started singing his songs, and to my surprise, I hear this voice from behind stage, "Seawalk, you've been holding out on me." I didn't know you could sing like that. So, of course, that opened the door for me to discuss with him, you know, what I was doing and my solo career and all that stuff.
Okay.
But just an amazing human being, and I tell you, I mean, he challenged me and encouraged me just like Ornette did.
Okay. Yeah, you know, the older I get, the more I realize that music at that level is a spiritual art. It's you know, it the people that pursue it at that level are really they're refining themselves through their efforts and their diligence at a very high level, and music happens to be the vehicle. But
yes,
there's a lot more going on in the notes.
And I'm going to tell you, we played New York at the Beacon Theater, and DiNardo came. And this was maybe 3-4 years ago. And when I introduced Al to DiNardo, he was in his no, wait a minute. It was actually less than 3 years ago. It was maybe a year ago. But anyway, so DiNardo, Al was in his wheelchair. And I introduced him to DiNardo and told him who he was, Ornette Coleman's son, Al stopped and stood up and said, "I have to stand up and shake his hand. I
wow.
absolutely loved your father and respect his music." I mean, and that just, you know, I mean, that just touched, you know, DiNardo touched my heart, you know, just to see the admiration that Al had for Ornette as well, you see.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah.
That's a great way to sort of sum up the life, because people would think, well, Al Jarreau, he's another style, he's in another world. Maybe he didn't even know who Ornette was. Maybe he didn't even like his, you know, who know, you know. But no, a recognition of a fellow soul.
Oh, absolutely.
Beautiful.
He knew what Ornette was doing. I mean, and of course, when he found out, I shared with him that I used to play with Ornette, and we talked about Ornette often.
Really?
Oh yes. He respected what Ornette was doing, and he loved the fact that Ornette had no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
he approaches music the same way, no boundaries.
Right.
You see.
Right, because his Al Jarreau's music was so unique, and so he'd go anywhere that he could imagine.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
And I was so excited when Ornette came to the concert and to have them to be able to stand there and hear the two of them talking was just magic for
me. Uh-huh.
I was
wow.
a kid in a candy store, you know.
Wow. You know, I'm really glad we documented this on tape so that people in the future that are trying to figure out what was going on in those years will know that Ornette Coleman and Al Jarreau knew each other and respected each other's music and were, you know, aware of each other and even had a chance, thanks to you, to meet and talk. Chris, what are you up to these days? How can people – I know you're in Houston, and you got the show coming up April 22nd at the Discovery Green in Houston. Do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes, chriswalkermusic.com.
Okay.
And also, we're doing a tribute, just so you know, to Al Jarreau on the Dave Koz cruise, which leaves out of Venice, Italy.
Really? Okay. The Dave – can you spell – do you know how to spell Koz? I don't – C-O-S?
Yeah,
C-O-Z?
K-O-Z.
K-O-Z, K-O-Z. Okay. You know, Ornette had a – he always would talk about spelling, you know. You know,
right.
It could be K-A-T or C-A-T. It's the same cat, though.
Right.
So Dave Koz out of Venice, Italy.
Right.
Or Venice.
That's May 9th through the 23rd.
May 9th through the 23rd. That's good
yes,
to know.
Right.
And then you mentioned that you're involved. You founded a nonprofit to help the kids at your high school get to the new school. Is that right?
Yes. It's entitled DocFest, and the website address is docfestjazz.org, docfestjazz.org. And, you know, basically we started it to honor my high school teacher and to raise scholarship funds for HSPVA students going to the New School for Jazz Contemporary Music in New York, which is also where I attended. So just my way of giving back and you know, thanking my teacher, of course, for accepting me in HSPVA and preparing me to be bold enough to go to New York with $40 in a dream.
I mean, $40 isn't much money today, and it wasn't much money in 1980s either.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, hey, you know what? Let's name your teacher maybe as our last thing on this call. So his name was Dr. Robert?
Robert Morgan.
Mm-hmm. Morgan, Dr. Robert Morgan. And, you know, he's in the line of many great educators who help lay the foundation for many, many great musicians in our country. And we really have to make sure that our local school districts are taking art and music education seriously, because this is where our great players all come from. They all,
absolutely.
I mean, even Sun Ra went to DeSable High School and got, you know, what if he didn't get that training as a young person? You know, we might never, and Ornette too. You know, Ornette was part, although I do hear Ornette was thrown off his high school band for playing bebop. Did you ever hear that story?
No, he told me the story about why he stopped playing tenor. Do you know that story?
When someone grabbed his tenor and beat it up and beat him up, or was that different?
He was playing in a club one time, and a fight broke out, and he thought it was because he was playing the tenor. So he goes home and explains to him, and he got into a kerfuffle with some people, and his tenor was damaged, and he thought it was because he was playing the tenor. So he went home and told his mother that he'll never play tenor again. That's
wow.
The story he told me, anyway.
So interesting. I remember reading in a book him talking about that. He, you know, he was such a sensitive person. I mean, a very strong person, very strong, but very sensitive at the same time. And yeah, he felt that there was something about the nature of the music they were playing that stirred up all these things, because he didn't play in very nice places as a young man. It wasn't, you know, the new school auditorium. You know, it was, you know, what they call a bucket of blood,
right?
Places. And they were, I don't think we can even imagine. I don't think there are places that rough anymore. And that's where he was as a teenager, witnessing this sense. I mean, imagine how sensitive he was when he was a teenager. If he was
right.
That sensitive as a 70 in his 70s, you know, he was still very always open. So
right.
It must have really affected him.
Yeah.
And I bet it made him think really deeply about music and the effect of music. And yeah.
Right. And if you ever talk to Donato, you can sense Ornette's spirit in him as well.
Oh, yeah.
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 I mean, those same sensitivities are there, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, this has been a beautiful call. I'm so happy to be able to add it to our archive to help people understand more about this great artist and this great man. And
yes.
And I hope everybody definitely check out chriswalkermusic.com and keep up with what Chris is up to. And, Chris, I hope I'll see you in New York City at Lincoln Center.
I'm looking forward to it. Yes, indeed.
Okay. Nice.
All right.
Great to talk with you.
You as well. Thank you.